Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be presenting the second of our two-part series about the 1991 Austin Yogurt Shop murders. Last weekend, I appeared at the True Crime Podcast Festival in Austin, and since the Yogurt Shop murders was one of my most highly requested cases which I had not yet covered, I thought now would be a good time to finally tackle it. But since it is such a convoluted story, I decided to make it a two-part episode. We released part one last week, which outlined the most important facts of the case, and if you haven't heard that episode yet, I suggest you go back and listen to it, since I'm going to be discussing a lot of the information I previously shared, as well as my own theories and analysis. So as a brief recap, this crime took place at an I Can't Believe It's Not Yogurt Shop in Austin, Texas, on the evening of December the 6th, 1991. Two of the victims were 17-year-old Eliza Thomas and 17-year-old Jennifer Harbison, employees who were both working the closing shift. The other two victims were Jennifer's 15-year-old sister, Sarah Harbison, and Sarah's 13-year-old best friend, Amy Ayers, who were hanging around the yogurt shop because Jennifer had promised to drive them back to her house for a sleepover after her shift ended. The four girls were last confirmed to be alive right before closing time, but shortly thereafter, one or more perpetrators likely forced them to strip before they were bound with their clothing, sexually assaulted, and shot in the head, and their bodies were also burned when the responsible party started a fire inside the shop. The case remained cold until the fall of 1999, when four suspects, Robert Springsteen, Michael Scott, Maurice Pierce, and Forrest Wellborn, were arrested for their alleged roles in the murders. The age range of these suspects at the time they supposedly committed this crime was between 15 and 17 years old, and the case against them was based largely on confessions which were made by Rob and Mike, who both wound up being convicted at their respective trials. However, both men recanted their confessions, claiming they had been coerced by law enforcement, and since Maurice and Forrest never did confess, there was not enough evidence to bring either of them to trial, so the murder charges against them were dropped. When an appeals court ruled that Rob and Mike's constitutional rights had been violated, they both had their convictions overturned before the murder charges were dismissed, and they were released in 2009. Even though Rob and Mike were not exonerated per se, the biggest obstacle against taking them to trial again was that new forensic testing turned up some unknown male DNA on the victims, which did not match any of the four suspects. Many people believe that a pair of unidentified men seen inside the yogurt shop near closing time were the real killers, but they have never been identified, and thus far, this male DNA has yet to be matched to anyone. There's definitely a lot to discuss about this controversial case, so without any further ado, I now present part two of our series on the Austin Yogurt Shop murders. So out of all the cases I've covered on this podcast, I can't think of many others that turned out to be a worse nightmare for the victims' families. We have four innocent teenage girls who were murdered in the most horrific fashion imaginable, and one family, the Harbisons, wound up losing both their children. One of the biggest side effects of cases involving wrongful or controversial convictions is the false hope it can provide. When someone is charged and sent to prison for murder, the victim's family is led to believe that their ordeal might finally be over, only for them to witness the suspect having their conviction overturned and walking free, with no one else ever being charged with the crime. This sort of thing has happened more times than I can count, but the circumstances of the Austin Yogurt Shop murders are particularly unique and frustrating. Here, we have four suspects who were originally charged with the crime, and while two of them went on trial and were convicted, the other two got to walk free due to lack of evidence. And since one of these suspects who went free, Maurice Pierce, was the alleged mastermind behind the yogurt shop murders, I'm sure it was a bittersweet feeling for the victims' families to see justice being served against some of the perpetrators, while the guy who supposedly orchestrated the whole thing continued getting away with it. To top everything off, Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott then had their convictions overturned and walked out of prison, so nearly 32 years after what is arguably the most infamous crime in the history of Austin, we still don't have any real justice or conclusive answers about who actually committed these murders. I first became familiar with this story when I saw it featured on the CBS true crime series 48 Hours, who have produced several episodes about this case over the years. Back when the crime originally happened, Erin Moriarty was the correspondent assigned to cover it, and she has said that she never imagined she would still be reporting on the case and hosting new episodes about it decades later. Moriarty has said that a major turning point for her occurred after the four suspects were arrested, and she got the opportunity to interview Forrest Wellborn while he was incarcerated in jail. I mentioned in my last episode that even though no one would ever accuse Forrest of being a man with great intellect, he was absolutely steadfast about maintaining his innocence and denying any involvement in the crime, even though he faced a lot of pressure from investigators to confess and implicate his alleged accomplices. During his 48 Hours interview, Forrest continued to state that he had nothing to do with these murders, and did so with such earnestness that Moriarty said she found him to be surprisingly credible. Indeed, Forrest was never directly accused of killing anyone, only that he functioned as a lookout and a getaway driver, yet he wouldn't even admit to this, and the evidence against him turned out to be so weak that the state was unable to secure a murder indictment from two grand juries, let alone bring him to trial. And lo and behold, it would be about a decade later when Erin Moriarty reported on the overturning of Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott's convictions and their release from prison. 48 Hours is still continuing to provide coverage of this case, as last summer, they produced yet another new episode, this time about the recent attempts to match the unknown male DNA to a suspect. Perhaps the most heartbreaking moment from all these 48 Hours episodes were the interview snippets with Jennifer and Sarah Harbison's mother Barbara and Eliza Thomas's mother Maria. Maria expressed pure rage and disappointment over the fact that these two men who supposedly murdered her daughter were going to walk free, stating, quote, "I felt like my head was going to spin out of my body, and it was because their rights were violated. Every time I hear those words, that their rights were violated, I feel like I'm going to go insane. Pretty angry, you know. Their rights are violated. Our girls were murdered," end quote. It was clear that in spite of the fact that the DNA didn't match them, Barbara and Maria still believe these guys were guilty, and tragically, Marie passed away a couple of years after the release without getting to witness real justice for her daughter. After all these years, I have no idea if all the victims' family members still believe that the authorities got the right guys all along, but unless this DNA evidence can lead to the arrest of another suspect or suspects, this case will continue to remain a never-ending nightmare for everyone involved. Now, two books have also been published about this case, and I use them both as research for these episodes. They are Murdered Innocence by Corey Mitchell, which came out in 2005, when Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott were still in prison, and Who Killed These Girls? The Unsolved Murders That Rocked a Texas Town by Beverly Lowry, which was released in 2016, long after the convictions were overturned, and there was a new effort underway to locate the source of the unidentified male DNA. Sadly, Corey Mitchell passed away in 2014, so an updated version of Murdered Innocence has never been released, but it is interesting to compare the two books. Who Killed These Girls clearly seems to hold the position that a major injustice occurred and that four innocent men were railroaded, but while Murdered Innocence does acknowledge that there were issues with the case against them, it doesn't really take a firm pro-innocence or pro-guilt position, which I suppose is to be expected, when it ends with only two out of the four alleged perpetrators being sent to prison. While certain elements of the book are now outdated, Murdered Innocence does go into more detail about the actual confessions and trials than Who Killed These Girls, so it is a very useful resource to take a balanced look at this case. Getting back to the 48 Hours episodes, the initial segments they produce contain a few cringeworthy moments, because since we're talking about a murder case from Texas during the early 1990s, you have to figure that satanic panic would enter the equation. During the early stages of the investigation, suspicion was directed towards a group of local residents nicknamed the People in Black, who were known for having an interest in the occult and vampirism, and performing activities like dancing on tombstones, so of course, rumors circulated that they were a satanic cult. This group was led by a woman who called herself Claire LeBay, which I don't believe was her real name, since I believe she was paying homage to Church of Satan founder Anton LeBay, and in Aaron Moriarty's earliest reporting of the case, she referred to this woman as a quote-unquote high priestess. Well, acting on a tip that LeBay may have been responsible for the yogurt shop murders, the Austin PD were filmed by 48 Hours performing a raid on a residence, and LeBay just happened to be naked and pleasuring herself with a vibrator on her bed when they burst inside. A skull and a bunch of bones were found in LeBay's residence, but the skull turned out to be made of wax, and the bones belonged to rats and squirrels. The whole thing was just overblown, as the People in Black were nothing more than a group of teenage and college-aged goth kids, so LeBay and her so-called followers ruled out as having any involvement in the murders. But given the circumstances, I suppose we can be thankful that when Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott later went on trial for the crime, the state didn't try to allege that the murders were part of some sort of satanic ritual. Now, if you watch all the aforementioned 48 Hours episodes, one person who constantly makes appearances is the case's former lead investigator from the Austin Police Department, Sergeant John Jones. Even though Jones has not worked on the investigation for nearly 30 years, it obviously still haunts him to this day, which is why he continues to give interviews and talk about it. The truly ironic thing is that on the night the murders took place, Jones had a news crew from a local CBS affiliate filming him on a ride-along inside his patrol car. The crew was producing a segment about homicide detectives who worked in larger cities, but up until that point, they had not yet gotten to witness Jones work a homicide. But on this particular night, they wound up recording footage of Jones responding to a radio call about a fire at the yogurt shop, unaware that they were about to become a part of one of the most controversial cases of the modern era. While you can certainly direct criticism at the actions of many of the investigators who worked this case, John Jones is not one of them, as he poured his heart and soul into attempting to solve these murders for nearly 3 years before he was taken off the investigation. Jones developed close relationships with the victims' families, but unfortunately, it also came at great cost to his relationship with his own wife and children. Devoting all his energies to such a horrific crime caused him to develop post-traumatic stress disorder and depression, which put great strain on his marriage and led to him getting divorced. For his own mental health, it was probably the best thing for Jones to be removed from the investigation, but if this had not occurred, I'm not sure that Robert Springsteen, Michael Scott, Maurice Pierce, or Forrest Wellborn ever would have been arrested. While some people might wonder why someone would confess to a crime they did not commit, especially a quadruple murder as heinous as this one, Jones claims that he had to investigate no less than 50 confessions in this case, which he found quite astounding. But he did not find any of these confessions to be credible, and decided that he would not arrest anyone who admitted to the crime unless there was additional corroborating evidence that implicated them. For instance, when word got out that Albert Jimenez Cortez and Porfirio Villa Saavedra had confessed to the murders in Mexico, it seemed like the case may have finally been solved, but Jones was the one who told the victims' families not to get their hopes up. And sure enough, he ultimately concluded that these two men's confessions were not credible and had likely been coerced by Mexican law enforcement officials who were hoping to take credit for solving a famous American crime. Of course, when Maurice Pierce confessed to his involvement in 1991 and implicated his three friends, Jones was the one who was skeptical about this and was ultimately inclined to believe that none of these four suspects had anything to do with the murders. For clarification, Jones did not say they were completely ruled out as suspects, only that they had been inactivated and were no longer top priorities in the investigation. But obviously, once Jones stopped working the case and the yogurt shop task force was assembled, those particular investigators felt differently. So now would be a good time to discuss Hector Polanco, the detective who originally interrogated Maurice and heard him admit his involvement. Now, Polanco was no longer working on the case when Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott confessed in 1999, so you can't blame him for that. But he was the one who opened the door for these guys to wind up on the radar as suspects to begin with. I mentioned during our last episode that during the early stages of the investigation, Polanco had obtained confessions from two other suspects which turned out to be bogus and led to him being taken off the case. Throughout his career, Polanco said that he had a quote-unquote gift for getting suspects to confess to crimes, but it would turn out that a number of these so-called confessions were made possible through unethical methods. I also mentioned during part one that I would be discussing another wrongful conviction case from Austin which caused Polanco to go down in infamy, and this one has some similarities to the Ogre Chop murders. On the morning of October the 24th, 1988, 20-year-old Nancy DePriest was working alone while opening up a Pizza Hut restaurant in Austin when she was tied up with her bra, raped, and fatally shot in the head. Days later, the Austin PD received a tip about 22-year-old Christopher Ochoa and 18-year-old Richard Danziger, a pair of roommates who worked at another Pizza Hut restaurant, but aroused suspicion because they showed up to drink beer in the parking lot of DePriest's restaurant and appeared to be raising a toast in her honor. While both men were separately interrogated about the crime, and while Danziger denied any involvement, Ochoa eventually confessed, and while he acknowledged that they had both raped DePriest, he said that Danziger was the one who actually shot her. In exchange for taking the death penalty off the table and receiving a sentence of life imprisonment, Ochoa agreed to testify against Danziger. But things got very strange when Danziger went to trial, and Ochoa suddenly changed his story on the witness stand. While he still testified that both of them had committed the crime, Ochoa now said that he pulled the trigger and shot DePriest rather than his partner. In spite of Ochoa's contradictory testimony, the jury still believed that Danziger was involved in the crime, but he was found guilty of rape rather than murder and received a life sentence. Well, guess who was one of the detectives who interrogated Ochoa and obtained his confession? Hector Polanco. Prior to this, Ochoa was an honors student who had no criminal record, and he eventually recanted his confession. He claimed that over the course of two 12-hour interrogation sessions, Polanco frequently yelled at him and said that he would become, quote-unquote, fresh meat and be raped by other inmates and eventually be executed for committing this crime. At one point, Polanco even threw a chair at him. Things reached the point when Ochoa finally told the detective what he wanted to hear, and he said that Polanco fed him details to share when his confession was typed up. It's possible that Ochoa and Danziger would have remained in prison indefinitely if another convicted criminal named Joaquin Joseph Marino had not come forward and confessed to Nancy DePriest's murder. Marino was serving three life sentences for a number of other crimes and had become a born-again Christian, so he decided to start sending out letters to the police and the Travis County District Attorney's Office in order to admit that he was solely responsible for killing DePriest and that Ochoa and Danziger were innocent. When Marino's confessions were ignored, he went so far as to send a letter to then-Texas Governor George W. Bush. It turned out that Marino's letters contained information about the crime that only the perpetrator could have known, and he also led the authorities to key pieces of evidence which had been hidden at his parents' house, including the murder weapon and the keys to the Pizza Hut restaurant. In addition, new DNA testing on a semen sample taken from DePriest's body excluded Ochoa and Danziger as the source, but could not exclude Marino. As a result of these new findings, Ochoa and Danziger were both released from prison in 2001 and fully exonerated the following year. Both men successfully filed wrongful conviction lawsuits and received millions of dollars in compensation, but unfortunately for Danziger, he had been violently attacked by another inmate in prison who kicked him in the head with steel-toed boots. This caused such severe brain damage that Danziger had to be transferred to a mental institution, and while he is now a free man again, he will require medical care for the rest of his life. Now, I mentioned in my last episode that Hector Polanco was dismissed from the Austin PD in 1992 after he coerced a false confession from a suspect named John Salazar for the murder of Travis County Sheriff's Deputy William Redman. It turned out that Salazar was in police custody for another crime at the time Redman was murdered, so it was physically impossible for him to have done this. but Salazar still confessed anyway, which should give you an idea of how anyone is capable of admitting to a crime they didn't commit if they face enough pressure. Even though Polanco lost his job, he was reinstated after an arbitration process, and since he had alleged that racism played a role in his dismissal, Polanco even won a federal civil rights lawsuit against the city of Austin and was awarded over $318,000. Following the controversy over the wrongful convictions of Christopher Ochoa and Richard Danziger, Polanco retired from the Austin PD with full benefits, and I do not believe that he ever faced any serious consequences for his actions in that case. I actually find the timing of these events to be quite troubling, because Ochoa and Danziger wound up being released from prison and exonerated around the same time that Robert Springsteen and Michael Scott's trials took place, which really should have compelled the people in power to take a second look at what was going on in the yogurt shop case. Like Maurice Pierce and Forrest Wellborn, Danziger was extensively interrogated and pressured into admitting his role in Nancy Dupree's murder, but he never did confess. But unlike those other two defendants, Danziger still wound up being convicted on an alleged co-conspirator's confession and testimony, and while he was eventually exonerated, the brain damage he suffered in prison completely ruined his life. We'll probably never really know why Maurice Pierce decided to implicate himself in the yogurt shop murders in the first place back in 1991, but John Jones theorized that he was suffering from some sort of mental problems at the time. However, it's worth noting that Maurice was extensively grilled by Polanco, but he never actually admitted full responsibility for the yogurt shop murders. He only provided a written statement that the .22 caliber weapon he was caught carrying had been used in the crime, which ballistics tests later proved to be false. Jones has always held the belief that if Polanco couldn't get Maurice to crack and make a full confession to the murders, then he probably didn't do it. And like I mentioned earlier, even though Forrest Wellborn was questioned extensively by multiple detectives over the course of several years, he never admitted any involvement at any point. Given that he was only accused of waiting in the car and functioning as a lookout, rather than directly participating in the murders, Forrest could have just claimed that he had no idea that anyone was going to get killed and receive full immunity if he had testified against his accomplices. But as far as I'm concerned, the fact that he wasn't even willing to do that speaks volumes. Anyway, this particular crime involves four victims and four accused defendants who all happen to be in the same age range, but their backgrounds couldn't be more different. By all accounts, Jennifer, Sarah, Eliza, and Amy could not have been better children, as they excelled academically, were known for being very responsible teens, and never caused any trouble. By contrast, Rob, Mike, Maurice, and Forrest did not excel academically, skipped school at every opportunity, and they all decided to drop out at some point. These guys were pretty much the working definition of aimless, dead-end kids who like to hang out, party, drink, and do drugs with very little consideration of their futures. They were also juvenile delinquents who sometimes got into trouble for committing petty crimes, but they did not have any known history of violence to suggest they were capable of something as heinous as the yogurt shop murders. And by the time they were arrested for the murders in 1999, they seemed to have put their wilder sides behind them by starting families and working steady jobs as respectable, law-abiding citizens. I remember that when I first became familiar with this case, before I even learned the full facts, I had a hard time imagining that a group of kids between the ages of 15 and 17 could be responsible for a quadruple homicide like this. Yes, people that age are capable of committing violent crimes, but this one seemed to have a level of organization and control of the victims to suggest that the perpetrators were experienced at this sort of thing and may have committed other murders in the past. Say what you will about these four suspects, but they appeared to be a group of disorganized slackers who barely knew what they were doing from one day to the next, so I'd expect them to leave a lot more incriminating evidence behind. And even though Maurice made some suspicious statements when he was picked up by police just over a week later, you would think that immature people like this would have had a hard time keeping their mouths shut, and there would be more documented accounts of them having bragged about the crime. So there's one topic I didn't discuss on last week's episode, and that's whether or not any of these four suspects had alibis on the night of the crime. And my only response is, well, they said they did, but their alibis are hardly rock solid. Rob, Mike, and Maurice each provided different accounts of what they were doing during the late evening hours of December the 6th, 1991, but who knows if any of them are accurate. When Michael Scott was interrogated in 1999, he actually apologized to the detectives in advance because he always struggled with memory issues, so how could he have an accurate recollection of what he was doing on a specific night, which took place nearly 8 years earlier? That's the complicated thing with alibis. If you're guilty of a crime, you might go to the trouble of attempting to fabricate one to cover for yourself, but if you're completely innocent, the day the crime took place is initially just going to seem like any other ordinary day, so you're not going to be thinking too hard about what you're doing at a specific time. Of course, if a loved one or someone you knew was murdered, you might have a pretty vivid memory of that day, but assuming these four guys are innocent, the four girls who were murdered at the yogurt shop were complete strangers to them, so trying to accurately remember what they were doing during the time period the girls were killed might be a bit of a challenge. These days, you can use stuff like cell phone records or social media posts to help track someone's movements in order to figure out where they were at a particular time on a particular day, but that wasn't the case back in 1991. What makes this situation even stranger is that Rob's father, Robert Springsteen III, had called the police to report his son missing on the morning of December the 6th, claiming that he had not seen Rob or Mike since December the 4th. Even though an incident report was filed, there was nothing to indicate it was ever followed up on, likely because the two boys resurfaced a short time later. But what's odd is that none of these people seem to have any recollection of this. As far as they remember, Rob and Mike woke up in the condo they were sharing on the morning of December the 6th, so there should have been no reason for Robert III to think they were missing. And when Robert III was called upon to testify at the trials years later, he had no memory of having called the police about this at all, even after being shown the original incident report. While you can assume that Robert III may have been lying to cover for his son, it's possible that he just legitimately forgot about it, and the passage of time has just hindered everyone's memories. I mean, even if Rob and Mike had disappeared between December the 4th and the 6th, I don't see how that proves or disproves that they committed the murders, since the crime took place on the evening of the 6th. Rob claimed that he snuck into a midnight screening of the Rocky Horror Picture Show at the North Cross Mall, but for whatever reason, Mike was unable to get inside, so he spent the next 2 hours hanging around in the lobby until the movie ended. Rob and Mike were then planning to go to a cast party for the event, but couldn't find it, so someone else gave them a ride back to Mike's mother's place, which is where they spent the night. However, Mike's recollection is that they both spent the evening partying with Maurice somewhere on 6th Street before Maurice drove the two friends back to their condo at around 10:30 p.m. After they split off from Maurice, Mike and Rob then said that they spent the rest of the night watching the movie Robin Hood Prince of Thieves on TV before they fell asleep. I do find Rob's statement about Mike being unable to sneak into the Rocky Horror Picture Show to be a bit odd, because I do not believe Rob actually specified that Mike was caught and thrown out of the theater. So why would Mike just hang out in the lobby for 2 hours rather than try to sneak in again? But even though Mike contradicted Rob's story about going to the theater, how much of that could be attributed to Mike's faulty memory? Now, during Maurice's initial interrogation, he claimed that after the murders took place, he, Rob, Mike, and Forrest all stole a Nissan Pathfinder from a dealership and took a joyride, and after spending the weekend in San Antonio and returning to Austin, they dropped the vehicle back off at the dealership. This part of the story has been confirmed to be true, because after they stole the Pathfinder, they stopped at a gas station to fuel up and drove off without paying, so the manager took down their license number and called the Austin PD. But the problem is that even though this incident took place on the morning of Sunday, December the 8th, the officer who answered the call wrote down the wrong date, December the 7th, and no one noticed this until years later, after the suspects were arrested. Of course, the murders took place during the late evening hours of Friday, December the 6th, so if these guys instantly stole a car the very next morning and got out of town as quickly as possible, that would definitely give off the impression that they were trying to distance themselves from the crime. However, if they did not steal the car and leave on their weekend getaway until the morning of Sunday the 8th, that isn't quite as suspicious and seems like nothing more than a group of juvenile delinquents getting into some trouble because they don't have anything better to do. So the confessions that Rob and Mike provided contain many of the warning signs you'll often see in false confessions during wrongful conviction cases. At numerous points during the interrogations, the detectives would tell both men that they were free to walk out if they wanted to, but often found ways to psychologically manipulate them so that they didn't. I mentioned earlier that Rob had worked multiple shifts at his two jobs and gotten about 6 hours of sleep during the past 3 days before a detective showed up at his door to take him in for questioning, so he was exhausted throughout the entire ordeal. At one point, when Rob shared his story about going to the movie theater at the North Cross Mall, Detective Ron Lara said, quote, "What if I told you that the Rocky Horror Picture Show never played there that night?" Of course, this was not true at all, as I seriously doubt the detectives even double-checked to see what movie was playing, but it caused Rob to doubt his alibi and wonder if investigators had caught him in a lie. Rob's defense attorney said that when he was videotaped uttering the shocking line, quote, "Okay, I put my dick in her pussy and I raped her," that pretty much sealed Rob's fate. While DNA testing would eventually show that this statement was not true, it's really hard to dissuade a jury that a defendant is not guilty when they see them make an admission like that. I've also pointed out Mike's self-admitted memory issues, but I think the detectives pushed him so hard that he became convinced that he may have been involved in the murders and did not remember it or just completely blocked the incident out of his memory, which is something that has happened with a number of false confessions that I've seen. There were also moments when both men would get details about the crime wrong before the detectives led them in the right direction until they got it correct. For instance, when Mike was asked what was used to tie up the victims, he initially provided incorrect answers like an extension cord or napkins. When Mike said they might have been tied up with a combination of a t-shirt and an electrical cord, Detective John Hardesty none too subtly started pushing him in the right direction until Mike finally said they were bound with their own clothing. Of course, after both men confessed and were arrested, investigators used bits and pieces of the details they shared to come up with a scenario for what happened, but there were a number of things about the scenario which didn't make sense. As an example, Rob and Mike made it sound like they didn't initially plan to kill anyone, but Maurice became angry because there wasn't as much cash in the register as he was expecting, and shot Eliza and Jennifer when they told him there wasn't any more money in the shop. But the issue is that there was an open bank bag containing additional money underneath the register. If Maurice was angry enough about the lack of cash to shoot the two employees, why would he leave this bank bag behind? There also seemed to be differing accounts about what happened to the .380 pistol which was used to shoot Amy. Rob apparently said that Maurice threw the gun off the bridge into Lake Austin, whereas Mike seemed to think that Rob was the one who did that. Yet at one point, Mike also claimed that he gave a paper bag containing a gun to his friend Patrick Davidson and told him to get rid of it. The .380 was never found, but I find it odd that these guys supposedly went to the trouble of getting rid of it, but made no apparent attempt to dispose of the .22 caliber pistol which was used in the crime. I think this was because the Austin PD wanted to maintain a narrative that the .22 they confiscated from Maurice at the North Cross Mall was the murder weapon, but even though ballistics tests showed that this was not the same gun used to shoot the girls, the detectives conveniently held out as long as possible without sharing this information. We had the same issue pop up when Rob and Mike confessed that they had used lighter fluid as an accelerant to set fire to the girls' bodies, even though this contradicted the report from the original arson investigator, Melvin Stahl, that the fire had been started on some metal shelves a few feet away. So the Austin PD had to get a second opinion from an ATF arson investigator named Marshall Littleton, who said that the fire started in the center of the room, and Stahl would even testify at the trials that he changed his mind after seeing Littleton's findings. I mean, I suppose Stahl was being sincere and legitimately believed that his original report had been wrong, but he also could have changed his mind after facing considerable pressure from investigators. It's very troubling that many key pieces of evidence, including these metal shelves, just happened to go missing, as it may have been useful to perform new testing on the shelves to determine if the fire really did start there. After all these years, Some people believe that the perpetrators never used lighter fluid or any accelerant at all to start the fire, as there were enough combustible materials at the shop, such as styrofoam cups, which could have burned strongly enough to cause a large fire to spread on their own. But since Rob and Mike both said that an accelerant was used to set the bodies on fire, the authorities had to craft a scenario to match the confessions, rather than making sure that the confessions matched the evidence. It was also convenient that Tim Stryker and Margaret Sheehan, the last two customers known to have frequented the yogurt shop that night, were never called upon to testify at Rob or Mike's trials. As you recall, they claimed to have seen two young men sitting at the table near the register when they left the shop at 10:47 p.m., and failed to identify either of them as any of the four suspects, though by their own admission, Stryker and Sheehan did not get a good look at these guys' faces. But regardless of whether or not these men were involved in the crime, this still doesn't change the fact that Rob and Mike's version of events were that they came into the shop earlier that evening and used a pack of cigarettes to prop the rear door open so they could sneak in that way after closing. I mean, theoretically, these two men could have just been ordinary customers who left the shop before Rob, Mike, and Maurice came in through the back, but I don't think the evidence points to that scenario. All the tables had their chairs placed on top of them, except for the one those two guys had been sitting at, and its napkin dispenser was also empty. And most importantly, the key was still in the front door's interior lock when firefighters arrived at the scene. The shop's standard procedure at closing time was for the employees to lock the front door at 10:50 p.m. to prevent any more customers from entering, and then ensure that any remaining customers who were still there left by 11 o'clock. When Stryker and Sheehan walked out, either Jennifer or Eliza likely locked the front door behind them, turned the close sign around, and then left the key in the lock. If the two men had left through the front door before the murders took place, it's reasonable to assume that one of the employees would have taken the key out of the lock. Now, we cannot conclusively prove that these two guys were responsible for the murder, but it is a red flag that they were never identified or interviewed by law enforcement. So if Stryker and Sheehan had gotten the opportunity to testify at Rob and Mike's trials, the defense might have been able to generate more reasonable doubt by pointing towards a pair of alternate suspects. But this is yet another example of the authorities ignoring potentially important evidence because it didn't fit the narrative of some questionable confessions. So the circumstances of how the convictions in this case occurred make my head spin. When you're dealing with a crime in which there are multiple perpetrators, it's not uncommon for each defendant to get a separate trial, but the drawback of this is that if the first defendant's trial ends with a conviction, there is a good chance that the jurors at the next defendant's trial are going to hear about this, which could cause bias with their verdict. I mean, you hope they would try to remain as unbiased as possible, but when jury selection occurred at Rob's trial, only one out of the 200 potential jurors said that they had never heard of the yogurt shop murders. So with a case this big, it's unavoidable that some of them might have had preconceived emotions. If Maurice Pierce had gone to trial, I'm sure he may have faced some juror bias over the fact that Rob and Mike were already found guilty at their respective trials, which is why it's pretty mind-blowing that the state wound up dropping the charges against Maurice before this took place. At the time, Texas law stated that a defendant could not go to trial if the only evidence against them was the testimony of an alleged criminal co-conspirator, and, well, that was literally all they had on Maurice. If Maurice had made his own admissible confession, then the rules would have been different, but without any other corroborating evidence, how is the prosecution going to sell to the jury that the 16-year-old high school dropout masterminded a quadruple murder? It is also a bit surprising that Rob and Mike were allowed to have their own confessions used against the other at their respective trials without corroborating testimony. You might be familiar with the infamous West Memphis 3 case from 1993, where Damian Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly were all charged and convicted for the murders of three boys. Since Miskelly confessed to the crime, he went on trial first, while Eccles and Baldwin were later tried together. However, because Eccles and Baldwin never confessed themselves, and Miskelly refused to testify against them, Miskelly's confession could not be mentioned or used as evidence at the second trial. If it had been, this technically would have been a violation of the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment, because if you're going to use an alleged co-conspirator's incriminating statements as evidence against a defendant, their defense attorney should have the right to cross-examine them on the witness stand. But since Rob and Mike refused to testify at the other's trial, their respective defense teams never got the opportunity to cross-examine them. This is the exact reason why both their convictions were overturned by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, but quite frankly, I'm surprised things even made it that far. If Rob and Mike are innocent, I don't want to use the word lucky to describe their situation, but considering that it can sometimes take decades to overturn a wrongful conviction, they had to spend less time behind bars than many people in this situation. However, even though they've been free men for the past 14 years, they have never officially been exonerated, as they were only released because of a civil rights violation, and the evidence has not conclusively proven their innocence. As a result, they've never been compensated for their imprisonment, and they are still technically convicted murderers in the eyes of the law. There's also the fact that Maurice Pierce wound up being fatally shot by police just over a year after Rob and Mike's convictions were overturned. Some might take this as a sign that Maurice was guilty all along, while conspiracy theorists might take it as an indication that Maurice's death was retribution from the Austin PD over their case having fallen apart. But I honestly do believe Officer Frank Wilson when he says that he had no idea who Maurice was when he pulled him over for what should have been a routine traffic stop. And since Maurice grabbed Wilson's knife and stabbed him in the neck, the shooting was definitely justified, and I think it's just a coincidence that Wilson wound up getting into a violent struggle with a suspect from one of the most infamous crimes in the history of Austin. Even though Maurice was never actually convicted of any crime, he still had to spend 3 years in jail awaiting trial until the murder charges were dropped, and I think this caused him to suffer some serious PTSD and spend the next few years experiencing constant paranoia that the police were going to arrest him again at any time. Maurice's final comments to his daughter on his cell phone while he was being pulled over seemed to indicate that he believed he was going to be arrested or killed, even though all he had done was fail to properly stop at a stop sign. So if Maurice was innocent, it is sad that he wound up being killed before he could experience full vindication. As for Forrest Wellborn, he pretty much completely disappeared from the spotlight after the charges against him were dropped in 2000. I don't believe he has done any other interviews after he appeared on 48 Hours, and I have no idea what he's up to today, but out of the four defendants, he was always the most unwavering about his innocence. Now, given that none of the DNA from the evidence or the murder scene has matched any of the defendants, you would think that should put an end to the debate about whether or not they were actually responsible for this crime, but the state attempted to counter this by pushing forward the narrative that this DNA might belong to an unidentified fifth accomplice who participated in the murders alongside these guys. However, that notion seems completely ridiculous, considering that Rob and Mike never mentioned anything about an additional accomplice during their confessions. Why would they willingly implicate Maurice and Forrest, but not say anything about this other guy? Sadly, this type of practice is not uncommon in wrongful conviction cases in which a murder victim was sexually assaulted, as the prosecution will sometimes invent what is known in legal circles as a quote-unquote unindicted co-ejaculator in order to explain why the DNA evidence does not match the defendant. In cases like the Holly Staker murder, we've seen the state push forward the narrative that the victim had consensual sex with another individual before they were killed, but the ironic thing is that this actually did occur in this case. There was semen in Jennifer's body, which matched the DNA of her boyfriend at the time, Sammy Buchanan, as they did have sex with each other hours before she was killed. But this point doesn't have any relevance here, since there are additional male DNA profiles besides Sammy's. And since one of them was taken from a vaginal swab performed on Amy Ayers, who was only 13 years old, the consensual sex theory is obviously not going to fly with her. No, the evidence clearly shows that the girls were raped by multiple individuals who were not Rob, Mike, Maurice, or Forrest. So obviously, over the past 5 years, we've seen DNA testing and genetic genealogy get used to solve a bunch of cold cases, but even though there is DNA evidence in this case, the solution is not that simple. Most of the focus has been placed on the DNA taken from Amy, which is not a complete profile, but rather a Y-STR profile, which only has 16 genetic markers. And whenever DNA samples are entered into a genealogical database, they usually have a lot more markers, which will allow them to link the crime to a specific individual. For a while, investigators thought they might be close to identifying a suspect because the Y-STR profile seemed to match an anonymous DNA sample which had been entered into a database at the University of Central Florida's National Center for Forensic Science. But again, the Y-STR profile only had 16 genetic markers, and when further testing was performed to increase the number to 25, one of these new markers did not match the sample in the database, which means this lead turned out to be a dead end. It's been reported that additional Y-STR DNA profiles were found on Sarah's body and the clothing used to bind Eliza's wrists, but I have to assume that these samples are quite small and may contain even fewer genetic markers than the sample taken from Amy. In other words, the DNA on its own is probably not going to be sufficient enough to identify and arrest a suspect, so additional corroborating evidence might be required. So if these four suspects were not responsible for this crime, then who was? Well, the most logical explanation is that it was the two unidentified men seen inside the yogurt shop right before closing, but before I talk about them, I want to discuss another possible angle. It goes without saying that it seems pretty surprising today that two 17-year-old girls were assigned to close the shop on their own at 11 p.m. on a Friday night. And as I'm sure you've probably figured out by now, no, this shop did not have any security cameras. I can definitely understand why the girls' families filed a lawsuit over this whole situation, considering that this shop was located in a strip mall where other businesses had experienced a series of robberies in the months prior to the murders. So obviously, this should have paved the way to some additional security measures being implemented before Eliza and Jennifer worked this closing shift on their own. In my last episode, I mentioned that the female yogurt shop manager at that time, Reese Price, claimed that she and Eliza had received some threats prior to the murders, and there were times when the shop's employees thought they heard odd noises in the crawl space, which connected them to an adjacent party shop next door. And there was one weird incident when Reese was working the closing shift and said she discovered shoe prints on the toilet in the men's washroom underneath what appeared to be an opening in the ceiling. So could this indicate that perhaps the perpetrators entered the shop through the crawl space rather than the back door? Well, if you search online discussions about this case, you'll see some suspicion directed towards the party shop's owner, Jorge Barney, who was working late that night past closing time in order to prepare for the upcoming Christmas season in an office which shared a wall with the yogurt shop's storage room. Barney said that he immediately smelled smoke and called the fire department, and even went outside to greet the police when they arrived. But oddly, he also said that he never heard any gunshots or screaming, even though the victims would have been killed near the opposite side of the wall in his office. Some people have found this a bit odd and wondered if Barney may have been involved in the murders or possibly used the crawl space to sneak into the yogurt shop from his store. However, I can only assume that Barney was extensively questioned and investigated, and I've read nothing to indicate that the Austin PD ever considered him to be a suspect. But Reese Price's story about her and Jennifer receiving threats and potentially being stalked does make me wonder if the crime may have been more personal in nature. Perhaps the killer or killers were someone who had developed a fixation on Jennifer or even Eliza and decided to attack them while they were closing the shop on their own. Or, since Reese apparently bore a bit of a resemblance to Jennifer, the killer actually had a fixation on her and was under the mistaken impression that Reese was working that night. Even though $540 was missing from the cash register, I still can't get over the fact that a bank bag filled with additional money was resting underneath the register and no one bothered to take it. I mean, I guess it's possible that the perpetrators just simply missed it, but it really makes me think that robbery was not the primary motive for this crime, and the responsible parties just wanted to brutally murder some people. Now, I've already outlined some of the compelling evidence which points to the two unidentified customers being the perpetrators, such as the key still being in the front door's lock, and the chairs they were sitting in not being stacked on top of the table. There's also the fact that an unopened Coke can and an empty styrofoam cup were found near the cash register, which has caused speculation that after Tim Stryker and Margaret Sheehan left the establishment, the two men may have approached the counter and ordered a Coke, but while Jennifer or Eliza were preparing to pour it, the suspects pulled out their guns. The last recorded transaction on the register was when the no sale button was pushed at 11:03 p.m., which was the button used to open the register when a transaction wasn't being rung through, so it's logical to assume that the men ordered the girls to open the register at gunpoint and give them the money inside. According to Stryker and Sheehan, they did not see Sarah or Amy while they were there, so the two girls were probably hanging out in the back. For all we know, the perpetrators may not have even been aware that Sarah and Amy were inside the shop, and this could have thrown off their original plan. The no-sale transaction was rung through at 11:03, the radio call about the fire took place at 11:47, and Melvin Stahl's original estimation was that the fire started at 11:42. This means the perpetrators may have been inside the building for around 40 minutes after emptying the register, so they clearly were not in a hurry to commit this crime and really wanted to inflict serious harm on these four girls. Like I mentioned earlier, I think it would have taken a lot of organization and control to handle four victims simultaneously, which is why I think there's a good chance that the perpetrators have committed additional crimes like this before and after the Yogurt Shop murders took place. But if those two men seen inside the shop before closing were the killers, who were they? While there has always been speculation that serial killer Kenneth Allen McDuff was responsible for this crime, particularly since he abducted Colleen Reed from an Austin car wash and killed her just over 3 weeks after the Yogurt Shop murders took place. That crime was committed with an accomplice named Alva Hank Worley, so could McDuff and Worley have been the two men seen in the shop? Now, McDuff was living in Waco at that time, which is about 100 miles away, but Worley said that they sometimes liked to drive to Austin because they could score drugs at a cheaper price. While Worley did confess to his involvement in Colleen Reed's abduction, he always maintained that McDuff dropped him off at his sister's place before he killed Colleen, so he was not present when her murder happened. I have no idea if this is actually true, but I'm sure Worley feared that he might get the death penalty if he was directly involved in Colleen's murder, and this would have been enough motivation for him to avoid admitting any role in the Yogurt Shop murders. Other than a sketchy eyewitness account that McDuff had been seen at the North Cross Mall on the evening of December the 6th, there is nothing to indicate that McDuff was in Austin on the night of the crime. McDuff and Worley also do not match the description of the two men seen inside the Yogurt Shop, as they were both apparently in their late 20s, early 30s. McDuff was 45 years old at that time, and, given what a heavy drug and alcohol user he was, looked considerably older than his age. And while Worley was 34 years old, he also had a large beard, and I believe the two men from the shop were both clean-shaven. Now, in the book Who Killed These Girls, Sergeant John Jones is asked about McDuff, and he conceded that of all the potential suspects he investigated, he felt that McDuff seemed like the most likely to have committed this crime, given the brutal nature of his other known murders. However, Jones said that McDuff was ruled out due to an alibi, though I've been unable to find any other source which specifically outlines what this alibi might have been. We've had anonymous sources report that McDuff confessed to the Yogurt Shop murders on the day of his execution in November of 1998, but investigators have never officially confirmed this. McDuff did confess to additional murders and led the authorities to some of his victims' bodies in the weeks prior to his execution, but even if he did confess to the Yogurt Shop murders, that doesn't necessarily mean he was telling the truth, as condemned murderers will sometimes just confess to random crimes at the last minute in hopes that it might cause their execution to be postponed so that investigators can look into their claims. But it's worth noting that following his arrest, McDuff was briefly questioned about the Yogurt Shop murders by an ATF agent, and McDuff said that if he had killed these girls, he would have been proud to say so. It's also worth noting that it's never been confirmed if McDuff's DNA was compared to the DNA evidence from the murder scene, but as a convicted serial killer, I'm sure that McDuff's DNA must be on file somewhere, and if there had been a match to him, we likely would have heard about it a long time ago. So while McDuff definitely seems like a compelling suspect on the surface, I am inclined to believe that he was not responsible for this crime. Now, before we bring this episode to a close, one more detail that I find unusual is that investigators have stated that they were able to account for every single customer who frequented the yogurt shop on the night of the murders, except the two men seen there at closing time. But what's odd is that we have additional accounts from other customers who reported seeing other young men acting strangely in the shop at earlier points during the evening. One of these customers was Lucella Jones, who said she saw two teenagers sitting at a table who appeared to be fixated on a small bag sometime between 8:15 and 8:30. I've never found this sighting to be particularly compelling, so I wonder if investigators did eventually identify these teenagers and ruled them out as suspects. But I am more compelled by the sighting from Daryl Croft, who reported seeing a fidgety young man in the shop between 9:30 and 10 o'clock, who ordered a Sprite before heading into the men's washroom, and Croft never saw him come out before he left. I have not heard any confirmation that this young man was identified, but I find it interesting that he was described as being in his 20s and wearing a green, military-style jacket, and one of the men at the table seen by Tim Stryker and Margaret Sheehan at closing time was also described as being in his 20s and wearing a green, army fatigue-style jacket. So while investigators have never officially said this, I do wonder if they are inclined to believe that the guy in the green jacket, seen by different witnesses 1 hour apart from each other, are actually the same person. That scenario would make sense, as perhaps he was hanging around the shop between 9:30 and 10 o'clock in order to scout the place, and he either left and later returned with an accomplice, or remained there until his accomplice joined him. And once closing time arrived, and the two men saw one of the girls lock the front door to prevent any more customers from coming inside, they went into action and committed the robbery and the murders. So overall, I think this is one of these crimes where I have a pretty good idea what happened and how the crime played out, but the big mystery is the identity of the perpetrators. And one thing I am pretty certain about is that the perpetrators were not Robert Springsteen, Michael Scott, Maurice Pierce, and Forrest Wellborn. I frequently mention that there's a good chance that the responsible parties have committed additional murders, and for all we know, they may currently be serving time in prison for other crimes, and we're just waiting for them to be linked to the yogurt shop murders. So yeah, this was a terrible tragedy for everyone involved, as 4 innocent girls lost their lives, 4 innocent young men were likely falsely implicated in this crime, and the victims' families and the community have not received a conclusive resolution after 3 decades. And this all came about because of a botched investigation, personal politics, and tunnel vision from authority figures who were unwilling to admit that they focused on the wrong suspects. Like I mentioned earlier, this does not appear to be a case in which DNA on its own is going to lead to an arrest, so it may require the right person to come forward with tips which point towards a suspect or suspects. So if you happen to have any information about the Austin Yogurt Shop murders, please contact the Austin Police Department at 512-472-TIPS. That's 512-472-TIPS. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives. This past month, I released a follow-up to a popular Patreon episode I did last year, where I discussed my top 10 favorite movies inspired by true crimes. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my 2 co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discussed the unexplained 1995 death of Devin Williams, which was profiled on Unsolved Mysteries. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have over 50 of these commentary tracks in our archives. Anyway, in just a couple of weeks, The Trail Went Cold will be appearing on Podcast Row at CrimeCon, which is being held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code, which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, So in order to do so, please visit crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLD23. That's COLD23. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for an all-new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶